The streets were empty again. The town was going to be solitary once more. And Oog kept repeating, "Dead, dead, dead town, Bruges la mort," mechanically, in an expressionless voice. "Dead, dead, dead town, Bruges la mort." The cadences of the last bells, weary and slow, little, worn-out old bells which seemed to be shedding petals. Was it on the town? Was it on a grave? From flowers of iron.
That was Think Negative. It was presented by Patrick McGuinness and produced by Paul Quinn, and the reader was Ewan Bailey. And it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. We first broadcast it last July. This is Radio 3. The time is 10:15, and we're about to cross live to the Royal Albert Hall for our late night prom. Lots of staging to do after our first prom of the night, and it's taking just a little longer than expected. Lots of BBC stage technicians working very hard to get everything in place so that the Aurora Orchestra can play, amongst other things, the UK premiere of the 10th Symphony by Philip Glass. So, while we wait for the green light, music by Eric Satie. Alexander Taro playing the second Nocturne by Eric Satie.
Wagner's Tannhäuser at the BBC Proms. Continuing this season's anniversary focus on the music of Richard Wagner, the tale of a troubadour who yearns for spiritual redemption, the woman who loves him, and the man who loves her. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Donald Runicles continue their acclaimed Wagner partnership at the BBC Proms. Sunday night from 6 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
This is Radio 3, still waiting for the stage to be reset for our late prom. Whilst we do so, let's hear some more music.
Este golpe que un amigo me mandó pa' que mañana o pasado haga lo mismo con yo. Yo vengo a trobar este golpe que un amigo me mandó pa' que mañana o pasado haga lo mismo con yo. Ahí viene Montilla a dar la pelea y viene diciendo morena, la bala chirrea. Él armó a su gente con la artillería y prendió los fuegos a morena y el ave María al estado que llegó Montilla.
Al estado que llegó Montilla.
Al estado que llegó Montilla. su gente con la artillería y prendió los fuegos morena y el Ave María. Al estado que llegó Montilla,
al estado que me han llegado,
al estado que llegó Montilla,
al estado que me han llegado,
al estado que llegó Montilla,
al estado que me han llegado,
al estado que llegó Montilla,
al estado que me han llegado.
Un hombre tan valeroso ya Montilla lo han matado, un hombre tan valeroso ya Montilla lo han matado. Viene, dicen que Montilla va, yo digo que eso es mentira porque yo vengo de allá. Dicen que Montilla viene, dicen que Montilla va, yo digo que eso es mentira porque yo vengo de allá. Ahí viene Montilla a dar la pelea y viene diciendo morena, la bala se vea. Él armó a su gente con la artillería y prendió los fuegos morena de la Ave María. Al estado que llegó Montilla,
al estado que llegó
Montilla,
al estado que llegó
Montilla. Un hombre tan valeroso ya Montilla lo han matado, un hombre tan valeroso ya Montilla lo han matado.
A lively song from Venezuela, Montilla, sung by members of La Peggiata, directed by Cristina Pluha. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after 20 past 10. Fiona Talkington introduces more highlights from WOMAD in tonight's Late Junction at a quarter to 11. Midnight, rather. But now we're live on the stage of the Royal Albert Hall as Andrew McGregor introduces the second of this evening's BBC Proms.
Hello, good evening. Thank you very much indeed for your patience. There's quite a lot of complexity resetting between the two proms this evening. Now, I was wondering how on earth I was going to actually describe what's about to happen on stage here at tonight's Late Prom. I'm still not entirely sure what to say, but we have three American composers, two essentially self-taught mavericks, plus one minimalist. One of them a rock star, famed for his scatological sense of humour, who was actually banned from performing right here in the Royal Albert Hall in the early 70s by the rather prudish management of the time. He was Frank Zappa, and this Late Prom ends with his, well, mock rock opera about an exceptional swine. To Zappa, The Adventures of Gregory Peccary was a twisted sort of musical fairy tale. And before it, the Aurora Orchestra in full symphonic form is going to whip up a knee-trembling tornado by Zappa again and give the UK premiere of the Symphony No. 10 by Philip Glass. And in just a moment, make the almost impossible possible. Give human form to one of Conlon Namcaro's fiendishly intricate studies for player piano. Well, the Auroras are led tonight by violinist Thomas Gould and conducted by Nicholas Collin, who's going to be discussing the music with me on stage. Well, Conlon Namcaro lived and worked in exile from America, basing himself in Mexico from 1940 and adapting player pianos to perform the ferociously complex and contrapuntally intense studies that he composed by punching holes in the paper piano rolls. Now, inhuman precision is called for with these things, so transcribing them for live performance by a chamber orchestra of 18 musicians brings a unique sense of danger, tension and exhilaration, I think, as we're about to find out. So to conduct the Aurora Orchestra in Namcaro's Study No. 7, arranged by Ivar Mikhashov, please welcome Nicholas Collin. Thank you. You've just heard the Aurora Orchestra performing the Player Piano Study No. 7 by Conlon Nankara, arranged for chamber orchestra by Ivar Mikashov and played by 18 members of the orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin, who's joined me on stage. Because, Nick, the Nankara piece, he used player pianos because he wanted that sort of inhuman precision. And it must be a huge challenge for live musicians to begin to perform this.
It is. It's extremely difficult rhythmically, as you may be able to tell. It sort of breaks down. He's actually written that piece, three main rhythms to it. The third one in particular is sort of mind-blowingly taxing. But the way it sort of builds up is quite simple, actually. The sort of the cells of the musical structure are quite simple, and he just builds up, I suppose, in a similar way as we'll see later in Philip Glass's symphony.
But also the way the sound changes is interesting as well, isn't it? Because after the brittle brilliance of the way he adapted player pianos, you've got that full range of colour and a different kind of dynamic possibility with an orchestra like this.
You do, exactly. And you can hear every instrument taken to the sort of extremes of their technique, the E-flat clarinet at the end, and indeed harpsichord and piano scales rushing around, bass clarinet doing that little solo. Bass clarinets don't like to do solos. They sort of usually sit back. But it's amazing hearing in an arrangement all these different sound colours that can come out.
And he was a huge admirer of Bach and Stravinsky as well. And yeah, you can hear both of those composers' influence in a piece like that, can't you?
That was nice. Yeah, you definitely can. You definitely can. But I suppose what's amazing about him and also the other composers in this programme is that, in a way, in America in the 20th century, and I suppose 21st century as well, you find composers like Nan Caro or Charles Ives, who are sort of unencumbered by the weight of Western European musical tradition, and they could go off and do their own thing. So they picked and chose what they wanted to from composers like Bach, Stravinsky, Webern, who was a big influence on Frank Zappa, but did their own thing and created their own unique voice, which I suppose also sounds in its own way American.
Well, we're going to hear another short piece that, Frank Zappa thought was really too tough for human musicians to play in just a few minutes. The Aurora Orchestra is about to grow, by the way, from 18 to, I think it's around 80 players, which is why there's such a lot of reorganisation going on behind us right now. Most of them are also needed for Philip Glass's Symphony No. 10. Now, it occurred to me earlier, listening to the Nan Caro, that while you'd never think of calling him a minimalist, there are some things, some sounds and some ideas in common with Glass's minimalism, aren't there?
Well, yes, I suppose there are. That idea of variable repetition, taking a cell, building it up, using it as the basis for the sort of structure of the piece, in a way that Frank Zappa wouldn't, for example. But that's obviously a hallmark of Philip Glass's, and no more so than in any of his symphonies.
Now, the 10th Symphony was written just a couple of years ago, and given its premiere in Aix-en-Provence by the French Youth Orchestra, for whom it was written, the French National Youth Orchestra. What are the main challenges for the players? Because I suppose after the Nan Caro, it's going to seem, well, not restrained exactly, but it doesn't have that sort of ferocious edge to it, does it?
It's got its own ferocious energy, as a lot of his music does. I suppose what's difficult about his music in performance is that it's almost like Schubert. It's very bare and clear. So any slight mishap in ensemble or even tuning is very audible. You also need to sort of interpret it. You can't get away with just sitting back and letting things or rhythms take over you. You have to sort of engage with it very actively.
And there are five movements, no titles, just tempo markings. It begins with all those characteristic Glass rhythmic patterns, doesn't it? It's the 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2, 1-2, and then it's repeated again and again. You just know where you are exactly, don't you?
Well, you know where you are exactly until he lulls you into that false sense of security and then changes something slightly, and then you're in a different place. But yeah, it's that idea which, of course, underpins all his music of using repetition to its full advantage, and that was such an amazing idea, really, that no one had fully thought of before the advent of minimalism.
And I found there was something slightly bluesy about the sounds and some almost sort of pop-like hooks, little simple melodies, which worked really well.
Yeah, I mean, this is unlike, I suppose, his early compositions. It was written very recently. His chamber music and small-scale works, or his solo piano etudes, have that sort of intimacy, which I think has gone out the window now, actually, in these later symphonies. It's a very different style of music, and harmonically very different as well. It actually changes more often than his smaller-scale intimate works.
Now, before the Glass, before the UK premiere of that 10th symphony, we're going to hear our first piece of Frank Zappa. Now, Nick, I suppose we have to describe Zappa first and foremost as a rock musician, but he was so much more than that, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think it's impossible to put Frank Zappa into any box. He defies categorization. I came across his music 3 or 4 years ago when actually I conducted The Adventures of Gregory Peccary before, and I was desperate really to bring it here for a late night prom. I think it's amazing music. I was totally bowled over by it, and being someone from, I suppose, a more classically orientated background, I was immediately drawn to the fact that he knows how, well, firstly, how to write extremely difficult, wonderful, intelligent and humorous music, but also none of it is easy. It's extremely challenging to perform and keeps us on the edge of our seats, and it's a sort of roller coaster ride.
And a little bit about that story of he and his band, the Mothers of Invention, being banned from the Royal Albert Hall in 1971, because he's about to get his revenge from the grave, isn't he?
It's probably worth mentioning right now as we stand on the stage. But yeah, I think it was back in the early 70s, and he was supposed to be performing a concert here with a London orchestra, which shall remain nameless. And I think because of the alleged obscenity of some of his lyrics, of which there are very few tonight, no obscene words, the concert was cancelled, and there was an amazing, hilarious obscenity trial in an old-fashioned 1970s English courtroom, which you can read about in the Real Frank Zappa book. It's very, very funny indeed.
It's really funny. And actually, the orchestra's spokesman, to be fair to them, did say some of the music is absolutely excellent and bears some similarity with Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. So not everyone in the orchestra was against it. Apparently, one of the offensive words that the manager of the hall at the time took against was brassiere. Anyway. The piece we're about to hear comes from Zappa's 1986 album, Jazz from Hell. Now, this was all written for an inhuman instrument, the synclavier, which he used to organise things at a sort of microscopic level.
That's right, and it's a lovely parallel with the player piano, which Nancarrow wrote for. This idea that he wanted a machine that could do things that humans can't, with that impossible precision. Again, unfortunately, someone's decided to arrange it for humans. So we sort of attempt to make that precision possible on a live platform.
And there is a story that this album, Jazz from Hell, has a unique claim to fame as well, because it's supposed to be the only purely instrumental album ever to be given one of those parental advisory stickers for explicit lyrics. Think about it. But it's probably because of the title of the piece we're going to hear, G-Spot Tornado. Or perhaps because the track after it on the album is called Damp Ankles. Maybe together they're just a little bit too much. Well, why did G-Spot Tornado end up getting arranged for orchestra?
I think it was part of... He arranged this album, The Yellow Shark, for Ensemble Moderne. So a series of 15, 20 works, I think. And I think during the rehearsal process, one of the instrumentalists was sitting there and realised, playing this piece, and he realised that it would work again brilliantly. And all these pieces are arranged by a guy called Ali Askin, absolutely amazingly, to again bring out the virtuosity of what live musicians can do.
Well, it's a huge orchestra that's gathering behind us as we speak, Nick, for such a short piece as well. So give us an idea of just what we've got behind us, especially for the audience at home.
Visually, there are two wonderful percussion instruments, the large tam-tam and the large bass drum. We have had in previous concerts with small tam-tams various accidents of tam-tams flying onto other players. So I'm hoping that it's weighted nicely because that would actually probably cause death. But two amazing instruments and a huge array of percussion and otherwise a fairly normal symphonic setup.
And lots of keyboards.
Oh, yeah.
And guitars.
Lots of keyboards and guitars, that's right.
And a mandolin, banjo, is it?
There is a mandolin back there.
Mandolin, yeah. Yes.
Why not?
Quite a lot. Well, Nick, thank you very much for talking. You go off and get ready. And as soon as the rest of the orchestra is in place, the strings are just coming on and arranging themselves at the moment. I'll get out of the way and let them tune. We've still got a few double basses arriving. Are we sitting comfortably? I think so. The UK premiere of Philip Glass's Symphony No. 10 is just a few minutes away, but before we hear it, here's Frank Zappa's... well, I'll give you his own definition of a composer from the Real Frank Zappa book. A composer is a guy who goes around forcing his will on unsuspecting air molecules, often with the assistance of unsuspecting musicians. And we're going to hear the Aurora Orchestra perform the exuberant orchestral showpiece that reaches the parts that other exuberant orchestral showpieces don't reach. Here's Nicholas Cullen to conduct G-Spot Tornado. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Wow. That was a juggernaut of an ending, wasn't it? We've just heard the UK premiere of the Symphony No. 10 by Philip Glass, performed by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Cullen, and before it, Frank Zappa's G-Spot Tornado, orchestrated by Ali Enaskin for the Ensemble Moderne back in 1991, and it still hits the spot. Well, Nick, after being almost trampled to death by the stampeding bass section, getting off for another big stage reset, we're going to reveal a very different side to Frank Zappa, really, aren't we? The Adventures of Gregory Peccary. Now, what is it, first of all? Should we call it an opera?
I can't really call it anything because it is what it is. It's beyond, again, like his music, beyond categorization. If I even tried to start to tell you the story, someone down here would tell me there's no story. So... It's just the most amazing sort of 20-minute... I think fantasy is probably the best word to describe it. It really is just an adventurous ride for this poor little pig.
And we've got two vocal parts. There's the narrator, originally Zappa himself, and a singer as this nocturnal, gregarious wild swine, Gregory. And it kind of lampoons two of Frank Zappa's pet hates, the American corporate capitalism and hippie counterculture, which usually got him frothing fairly quickly. It was originally released on the album Studio Tan in 1978, and I guess you get a real idea of the range of Zappa's musical... width is everything from sort of television advertising, jingles, is TV theme tunes, and the orchestra we've got assembled on stage here. It's like a combination of a rock band at the heart of it. There's a jazz ensemble, classical chamber orchestra. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, again, this was arranged by Ali Askin brilliantly, alongside Frank Zappa. Frank knew all these arrangements and had a hand in them. But it manages to sort of recreate the essence of what Frank Zappa managed to do with his own band. But also, it gives it a new dimension, brings it even more alive. I think that there's so many vivid colours that you get in this arrangement for ensemble that even you don't get in the original versions.
And cartoon music, the rock influences are very obvious. There's avant-garde jazz, contemporary composition as well. But this does feel more, I suppose, like Zappa the rock musician and less like Zappa the composer.
I suppose you could say so. I mean, this is the kind of piece where he changed it constantly. It varied in length. I'm sure he improvised a bit when he played it in sets. So it's very much him, his own personality on stage, and he needed an audience. That's what got him going, I suppose, is that sort of live ability to tell this story, this crazy story, really is, to a live audience.
Well, there's one element of what's being put on stage that the audience listening at home won't be aware of, but we are in the hall. There's a little typing pool being assembled just to the right of the stage, isn't there?
Yeah, the second part is set in a steno pool, so sort of I think of it a bit like a sort of Mad Men style 1950s steno pool. You can hear the typewriters; they play them like almost like percussion instruments.
And there are other electronic elements as well, which are part of the mix, aren't there? So what do we actually hear that we can't see on stage?
Well, they're bass guitar, guitars, the kit, which is a huge part of the piece, massive array of percussion. Glad to see our two big instruments are still standing. and then just a sort of contemporary ensemble style set up in front of it with two synthesizers doing loads of work.
And there's quite a few samples being triggered at various points.
Lots of
samples. And live vocal contributions from the Aurora Orchestra, yes?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yes, indeed, there is. I'd forgotten. one, yes.
One, okay. Well, Nick, thanks for talking to us.
I think
it's time to let you just collect your thoughts off stage, and we'll let the orchestra tune again. Well, I was thinking of giving you some kind of synopsis of Gregory Peccary, but really, it's all made so clear by the narration, and we're beautifully introduced to our heroic pig right at the start, so there's really very little point me preempting it. So to perform Frank Zappa's The Adventures of Gregory Peccary, please welcome back conductor Nicholas Collin with our narrator, a musician, comedian and writer famous for his own satirical rock songs on Radio 4's The Now Show, Mitch Benn. And trotting around somewhere backstage, getting into character as Gregory Peccary, is baritone Christopher Purvis.
Adventures of Gregory Peccary.
Oh, here comes Gregory, little Gregory Peccary, the nocturnal gregarious swine.
A peccary is a little pig with a white collar that usually hangs around between Texas and Paraguay. Sometimes ranging as far west as Catalina.
Catalina, Catalina, Catalina!
This particular peccary is part of that bold,
new
breeding that extinguishes itself by markings which resemble a white tie directly beneath the white collar.
It's wide enough, everyone will know. That I am wearing is a symbol of a nimble my mind will go.
Whack, suave. Look out! Here he comes again!
Oh, here comes Gregory Peccary!
Drives his little red Volkswagen to the ugly part of the town where they keep the government buildings.
Fuyum! Fuyum!
Thank you.
Gregory takes the elevator up to the 83rd floor of a grim, gray, evil-looking building with a sign on the front reading, Big Swifty and Associates, Grandmonger. A trendmonger. Well, a trendmonger is a person who dreams up a trend, like the twist or flower power. And spreads it throughout the land using all the frightening little skills which science has made available. Morning, Gregory Peccary made his way through the Steno pool.
I love it. Hi, Mildred. Hello, Gladys.
Wanda.
Yes, from the moment they laid eyes on him, all the girls in the Big Swifty Steno pool knew here was a nocturnal gregarious wild swine on his way up a peccary of destiny, adventure, and romance.
Is there any mail for me?
For you?
I'm a puppet boldly forward to my ultra avant simulated replica mahogany desk with the strategically placed imported very hip water pipe and the latest edition of the whole earth catalog, and rack my agile mind for a spectacular new trend, thereby rejuvenating our limping economy, providing for bored physical people everywhere some great new thing to identify with. We're busy making them. Busy making them. Busy making them for you. Oh. Highly efficient, Miss Snodgrass.
And with that, Gregory turned and strode nonchalantly into his dinky little office with the desk and the catalog and the very hip water pipe, and proceeded with a vigor and determination known only to piglets of a similarly diminutive proportion to single-handedly invent the calendar. With his eyes rolled heavenward and his little shiny pig hoofs on the desk, Gregory ponders the question of eternity and fractional divisions thereof as mysterious angelic voices sing to him from a great distance, providing the necessary clues for the construction of his thrilling new trend. The calendar, in all of its colorful disguises, was presented to the bored and miserable people everywhere. Gregory issued a memo on it, whereupon the entire contents of the steno pool identified with it strenuously and worshipped it as a way of life and took their little pills by it and went back and forth from work by it and paid their rent by it. And before long, they were even having birthday parties in the office by it, because now, at last, Gregory Peckery's exciting new invention had made it possible for everyone to find out how old they were.
What hath God wrought?
Unfortunately, there were some people who simply did not wish to know, and that's why, on his way home from the office one night, Gregory was attacked by a rage of henchmen! Making his way through the evening traffic, Gregory notices that the other vehicles which crowd and bump his little red car are all inhabited by slowly aging, very hip, young people. They appear to be casting sinister glances toward him through their glinting acid burnout eyeballs, trying to run him off the road or make him bump into something, giving strong evidence of hostile aggression. To elude them, Gregory takes the short forest exit off the expressway. They zoom after him in all manner of cars, trucks, garishly painted buses, and motorcycles. Gregory takes a bumpy trail off the main short forest road, which leads him up the side of a famous and conveniently placed mountain, and into a strange cave on the edge of a cliff, not far from a little twisted tree with eyes on it. Meanwhile, the enraged hunchmen and hunchwomen rumble through the short forest until, realizing the little swine has escaped, they decide to park their steaming vehicles in a circular pseudo-wagon train formation and have a lovin'. Under the influence of a fantastic amount of trendy chemical amusement aid, they proceed to perform lewd acts. Rip each other off for small personal possessions, and dance with depraved abandon in the vicinity of a 6-foot pile of transistor radios, each one tuned to a different station. finally expire from exhaustion, and Gregory, who has viewed the proceedings from a safe distance, breathes a sigh of relief.
Phew!
Only to be terrified once again by a roar of immense laughter. Which seems to be rumbling up from the very depths of the cave in which he has hidden his car.
Good Lord, what was that?
Gregory doesn't realize that he has concealed himself inside the very mouth of Billy the Mountain. And as you all know, whenever Billy laughs, rocks and boulders hack up, and the air for miles around is filled with tons of dust, forming a series of huge round clouds.
Who is making those new round clouds? Who is making those clouds these days? Who is making those new round clouds? Better ask the philosopher and see what he says.
Gregory stops at a gas station and makes a mysterious phone call.
Is this the old loft with the paint peeling off it by the Chinese police where the dogs roll by? Is this where they keep the philosophers now? With the rugs and the dust where the books go to die? How many he's got? How see he's got quite a few just sitting around there with nothing to do. But I just caught his eye because I wanted to see the philosopher be of assistance.
Gregory receives information that the greatest living philosopher known to mankind is currently in possession of the information in question. And furthermore, this information could be his if only Gregory would attend a special therapeutic group assembly. Class is now forming and available at a special low, low introductory fee. And now, here he is, the greatest living philosopher known to mankind, Quentin Robert de Nameland. Take it away.
Folks, as you can see for yourself, the way this clock over here is behaving, time is of affliction. Now, this might be cause for alarm among a portion of you, as from a certain experience I tend to proclaim.
Make your checks payable to Quentin Robert de Nameland, greatest living philosopher known to mankind!
The Adventures of Gregory Peccary by Frank Zappa, one of the most complex, uncompromising, original musical talents ever to wield a guitar in front of a band, and who died 20 years ago at the age of 53. In the role of Gregory Peccary, you heard baritone Christopher Purvis, and the laughter when he arrived on stage was because he's managed to find a pink pig costume to frame his performance. The narrator was comedian and satirical songwriter Mitch Benn, and if you heard Frank Zappa himself narrating Gregory Peccary, then you'll know what a tremendous job Mitch made of adopting what Zappa called, well, putting the eyebrows on it, he said of it. The Aurora Orchestra was led by Thomas Gould and conducted by Nicholas Colon. And my thanks to Nick for being such an interesting companion in our onstage discussions. And don't forget, if you missed any of the Nankara Glass or Zappa we've had in this late prom, then you can listen again online using the iPlayer radio. Well, Frank Zappa had a love-hate relationship with the Symphony Orchestra, but I think love won in the end. The orchestra, he wrote, is the ultimate instrument, and conducting one is an unbelievable sensation. Nothing else is like it. Except maybe singing doo-wop harmony and hearing the chords come out right. Well, back in Broadcasting House, always perfectly in tune, here's Ian Skelly.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. Andrew McGregor, among the pigs, the trendmongers and the hunchmen, as Frank Zappa would have called them. Well, tomorrow night, Oliver Nussen conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Hans Werner Henze, Stravinsky and Tippett's Second Symphony. That's all at 7:30 tomorrow night. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and in high-definition sound online. Time now for Late Junction, presented by Fiona Talkington.
Oh, çayları kaynap dursaydı. Sana verim bulsaydı, çayları kaynap dursaydı. Ver içine çayını içkice yallah oynap dursaydı. Ver içine çayını içkice yallah oynap dursaydı. Saziman çölde uçkan kaziman, sana verdim saziman çölde uçkan kaziman. Düşmen bilen can değilim ülgenim geraziman. Düşmen bilen can değilim ülgenim geraziman. Sana verdim bol sire çayları kaynap dur sire. Samalarım olsaydı, çayları kaynap dursaydı. Ben seni çayını içtiğince yalan oynap dursaydı. Ben seni çayını içtiğince yalan oynap dursaydı.
Again, and welcome to Late Junction. A slightly later than usual start tonight after that inspiring late night prom. North Chinese rock meets desert blues in that opener from a band called Ketik from their album Rock from Taklamakan Desert, which, and I didn't know this, is the biggest sand desert after the Sahara. Well, it was great to meet so many of you at WOMAD last weekend. And although we've got a shorter than usual Late Junction tonight, I've still got time to play you some of the music recorded by Radio 3 over the weekend. And beginning tonight with a young band from southern Italy whose music is inspired by the pizzica tradition, the traditional dances associated with the bite of the tarantula. And they are Cantoniere Grecanico Salentino.